You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to Table Talk, a guide to the future of food and nutrition, brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we chat with visionaries from across the food industry to discover the ideas that will transform our food landscape. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, broadcaster, and all-round gastronaut. Now, when was the last time you woke up feeling fully refreshed? Well, if it's been a while, then you're not alone. We've turned into a restless nation. The first lockdown triggered a sharp increase in anxiety-related sleeping problems, with a number of Britons suffering sleep loss caused by worrying, rising from 1 in 6 to 1 in 4. And yet, a good sleeping pattern helps the body remain healthy and stave off diseases, as well as its essential function of recharging body and mind. So, should we wake up to the problems of sleeplessness and start treating it more seriously? And what is the connection between sleep and food? Well, with me to discuss this are Dr. Ali Hare, consultant in sleep and ventilation, Royal Brompton Hospitals Trust. Hello, Ali.
Hi, Stefan.
And Dr. Neil Stanley, director of sleep science at sleepstation.org.uk. Hello, Neil.
Good morning, Stefan.
Excellent. Now, Ali, let's start with you. How did you sleep last night?
Very well, thanks. Yeah, I don't tend to suffer.
You're just saying that, aren't you? You're just saying that.
No, I don't tend to suffer with the Sunday night dreads. But I know lots of people do. So it was shifted across because we had that bank holiday Monday. But I know lots of people really struggle with the night before they go back to work on a Monday or Tuesday, as it was this week.
Do they? I didn't even know that. Well, that's what we'll talk about. Neil, how did you sleep last night?
Well, as you say, after 39 years as a sleep expert, you'd rather expect me to say that, yes, I slept perfectly well. If I said anything else, you'd think I was a fraud. So I actually slept really well last night.
No. You could sleep badly, and that could be why you're drawn to researching it.
I slept well last night.
You did sleep well. Very good. Okay. You're both fibbing, I know. No, I'm sure you're not. I slept like a log, actually. Pretty good. How would you define, Ali, how would you define a good night's sleep?
So I tend to define a good night's sleep by how you feel in the daytime, actually. And I think that's probably what's most important to all of us. So if you wake up feeling fairly refreshed, you don't necessarily have to wake up full of the joys of spring immediately, but you feel rested and you can go about your day with enough energy and enough vitality and enthusiasm to get through the day without dropping off or without feeling exhausted, then I think you're having a good night's sleep.
Okay, that sounds pretty good. Neil, what are the effects on our mind and body if we don't get a good night's sleep?
Well, I mean, sleep is what we call about homeostasis, which is basically balance. So everything that we do, everything we feel is managed by our sleep, which is why we spend 8 hours of our life doing it, because it's vitally important. So in the short term, we crave more sugary and fatty foods if we haven't had a good night's sleep. Our relationship will suffer. You'll have more arguments with your partner. You'll lack empathy with your partner. Your ability to plan, make decisions, problem solve will be affected. You'll have an increased risk of accidents, whether at work or in the car. So those are the short term, the things you'll feel the next day. In the long term, there's associations with increases in obesity and diabetes, mental illness, and there are associations with major health conditions like stroke, heart disease, and dementia. So the sleep, after 1 million years of evolution, if sleep wasn't important, we wouldn't be doing it. The fact that we do it, the fact we do it every single night for 8 hours, just means that it plays such a vital role, and we neglect it at our peril. And this is the problem, because food and exercise take up a small portion of our day, but sleep just takes up a third of our life. There must be a reason for it. And the reason for it is because it underpins every other thing we do in life. It strengthens the immune system, the endocrine system, the metabolic system, as I say, that link with our diet, exercise. If you exercise, if you're sleepy, you're at a 75% increased risk of a sports-related injury. It just cuts fundamentally across everything we do.
It's an interesting idea, that we haven't evolved out of sleeping. Are there any animals that either of you know of that do not sleep, that just carry on throughout?
Sorry, Ali.
Sorry, Neil. It varies across the animal kingdom hugely, doesn't it, Neil? How much sleep different species need is hugely variable, and the type of sleep species have is highly variable. But as Neil quite rightly says, you know, despite evolutionary pressure not to sleep, so if you are a wild animal, obviously sleep is a really bad idea fundamentally. Yeah. You know, you can't protect yourself from predators, you can't protect your young, you can't reproduce, you can't gather food. So Neil's quite right from an evolutionary perspective that sleep survives, that sleep continues, and in every animal species thus far studied there is some form of sleep, although it's highly variable. Then Neil's quite right, it shows how important sleep is fundamentally to all species.
Now, sleep's become big business in the last few years, hasn't it? I would imagine both of you feel that your discipline is having a moment in the sun, well, hopefully more than a moment in the sun. Why do you think people are now so much more aware of the importance of sleep? And or is there still quite a long way to go, do you think? Ali, if you can answer that for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is part of an overall move towards understanding more about our health and our well-being in particular. So I think people are increasingly aware of trying to conduct their lives in a way that's more conducive to good physical and mental health. So I think it's ridden that wave, which is wonderful, as you say, for people like Neil and I who've been banging this drum for a long, long time. But I think also people, and indeed perhaps us as sleep specialists and sleep scientists, have also become a bit better at sort of getting that message out there in different ways about, you know, the message that sleep is really important for our physical and mental health. Because it wasn't that long ago that, you know, it was quite trendy to talk about how much you could achieve on a very small amount of sleep.
Maggie Thatcher. Yeah.
Well, I was just about to invoke her. You know, so you know, I definitely think sort of in the late 80s and early 90s, it was you know, a badge of honour to talk about how much you could achieve throughout the 24-hour period. Mm.
And if anyone's not aware of it, Maggie Thatcher claimed that she needed 4 hours, only needed 4 hours of sleep every night, which was a bit of a shock when John Major came in after her needing 8 hours, and everyone went, oh, hang on. All right, let's slow down a little bit. But that sort of you know, butchness of I only need 4 hours sleep a night. I mean, that's no longer seen as positive or useful, isn't it?
I mean, I think you're right. You know, you talked about whether there's a bit further to go. So I think there's definitely a large movement towards understanding that, as you say, that kind of butch attitude that, you know, you work 21 hours a day, and when you're sleeping, you're basically, you know, kind of lazy or you're non-productive. I think there has been a move away from that because, as Neil's just described really eloquently, people increasingly understand that actually good performance relates to sufficient sleep. So you perform better when you've slept better. But I think we do still have a long way to go. So there's still definitely, I think, a message from employers and large corporates that, you know, there's a sense that one should be on all the time. And I guess, you know, the encroachment of things like email and these sorts of, you know, webinars and things, you know, we can do these from our own homes and we can kind of do them at any time we like. And so there's that sort of pull in the other direction, which is that, you know, if you get an email that's coming in from overseas, say from the US at 2 a.m., do you answer that? Or, you know, is it legitimate to say that you're sleeping? Mm. Obviously, Neil and I would say it's very legitimate to sleep, but I think there is a bit of a push and pull there.
Yeah, so Neil, do you think there'll come a point where people will say, it will be more, you know, butch, not butch, but it'll be more positive to say, no, I'm sleeping, and people will go, oh, cool.
Well, that I think is the question as to the future, because as you say, the macho idea of the short sleep, but we still don't have anybody in public who has ever sort of turned around and says, I'm good at what I do because I sleep 8 hours. The only people who ever do that are supermodels. And let's be honest, that's not really the person we need. And I don't know if you remember, quite a few years ago, David Beckham appeared in an art installation where he was meant to be asleep. And that would have been a great opportunity for somebody like Beckham to have turned around and said, you know, I am a brilliant football player because I get 8 hours sleep. And there's very few people. I mean, there's Roger Federer, who we know, prioritize it. There's, you know, some American athletes, but it really isn't something that you can get away with. I mean, if you say I eat my five a day and I go for a 5 mile jog, people say, well done, good for you. You say I sleep 9.5 hours a night and they go, you sad person with no friends. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. It's not sexy to sleep. It's not seen as a positive to do. And that I think is where we have problems. I mean, say I've been involved in sleep research for 39 years. I still have not found a way of getting people to take sleep seriously. Sleep is the thing you do at the end of the day because you've done all the other fun things. You've watched Netflix, you've watched the funny cat video, you've talked to your friend, and now you sleep. Rather than in the past, sleep was, you know, a pleasure, a joy, and that's the bit we're missing. We're missing the joy that getting a good night's sleep is one of the best feelings you can get, and yet we spend our lives, you know, taking multivitamins, having half a bottle of wine on a Friday night, going to spas to feel good, and yet the thing that makes you feel good each and every night, we think, oh, I don't want to waste my time doing that. And I think that's the problem. There needs to be a conceptual change in people's mindset.
Yeah. So, Ali, now I know somebody who really likes a nap in the afternoon. Obviously, I'm asking for a friend here. And when there's a gap between podcasts, he will often dive onto the sofa for a quick 20 minutes hard kip. Now, is his wife bang out of order for saying that he's lazy? As I say, I'm asking for a friend here.
Asking for a friend. Look, I mean, I think naps are really great when they're used appropriately. And you talked about 20 minutes. And I think when I advise people on napping, 20 minutes is a really good time for a nap. So there's very good evidence that a nap of around about 20 to 30 minutes does create improvements in your attention, in your performance. And certainly, I think if you're a shift worker, for example, or, you know, I don't know, you do podcasts in the middle of the night, your friend does, you know, then you know, a nap is a really good way of getting your performance back on track. And certainly if you're a driver, for example, and you're starting to feel tired, then I would always run it, nap somewhere safe, obviously, before you get back on the road or before you even start driving.
And do you have a nap in the afternoon? Do you cozy up by those filing cabinets behind you and have a little nap?
No, because I focus on my core sleep, which is what I was about to advise you on. You know, I think if you're a good, healthy sleeper and you don't work shifts, you know, you're not a night shift worker, you don't do late shifts, you shouldn't need a nap in the afternoon. If you've got young children, you're disturbed in the night for that reason, or as I say, you're working shifts, then by all means have that afternoon nap. But, you know, really you should be focusing on your core sleep, which happens at night. That's when our circadian rhythm asks us to sleep. We do have a mid-afternoon lull. That's definitely real. It's usually the time Neil and I are asked to do lectures on sleep about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I think if you're constantly needing a 20-minute nap in the mid-afternoon, you need to take a look at your core sleep at night.
Yeah, whatever. You're absolutely right. I'm being flippant. Now, this is a program that is listened to by a lot of people in the food business. What is the relationship, Neil, between sleep and diet?
Well, the interesting thing about the research is the link between sleep and appetite. If you are sleeping, you crave energy-rich food, so sugary and fatty foods. So you have an increase in ghrelin, which is the appetite hormone. So you want to eat more. And you have a resistance to something called leptin, which is the thing that basically tells you you're full. So you want to eat, sugary, fatty foods, and you do eat sugary and fatty foods. So research from Ev Van Kouter's group in America shows that if you have two nights of 4 hours sleep, then on the third day, you'll eat up to approximately 1,000 calories more simply because you are sleepy.
That's a huge amount, isn't it?
Yeah, but the thing is, there's a good theory behind this, which is that we're eating for the winter that never comes. Because in the past, we had to eat in the summer, put the fat on, because over the winter, there was no food, we ran the risk of starving. Now, winter is denoted by long nights and cold temperatures. We don't have that anymore. We have central heating and we have electric light. So we're, every time we have short sleep, the body's going, oh my God, it's summer. I can eat, I can eat, I can eat, because I need to put on calories. And so there was a Swiss study that shows that in women, year on year, if you sleep less than 6 hours, you'll put on about half a BMI point every year across 14 years. So if you want to lose weight or maintain a healthy weight, the first thing you should do is get your sleep, because that will make dieting so much easier because you won't have those cravings. But with regards to whether there is a link between food and sleep, the only real link is if you eat too late at night, you have to burn off those calories. And in order to get a good night's sleep, you need to lose 1 degree of body temperature overnight. So if you're burning off calories, that's the opposite of what you want to do, which is why you'll have a restless night. But anybody who says you have to eat this, that, or the other, you know, a banana before bed or anything like that, no, you need to eat food.
Yeah.
That's what you need to do. Eat food, and that's good. Because if you want tryptophan, and there's no evidence that tryptophan in your diet has any effect on your sleep, so this is why people say eat a banana. But the best source of tryptophan, if you're going to do that, is a turkey sandwich on white bread. Now that to me sounds like supper, whereas a banana before bed just sounds weird to me. It's just not right. So there's no reason to eat. You'll get tryptophan from anything that has protein, and if you eat food, you'll get protein. You don't have to do anything. Just don't eat late at night. And people say, oh, spicy food disturbs sleep. Well, that means about 6 billion people in the world automatically have poor sleep because they eat spicier than the Western European diet, which is a nonsense. If you've always eaten a korma and you go out and have a vindaloo, maybe you're not going to get the best night's sleep that night. But that's got nothing to do with spicy food. It's got to do with the fact that you don't eat spicy food, sort of thing. Yeah. So just eat, enjoy food, enjoy sleep.
And is there a nutritional connection between a decent diet and good sleep, or are you pretty much saying, you know, food or not?
If you're deficient, and of course some populations are deficient in certain things, so vitamin D, magnesium, but if you read if you go onto the internet, the people who are trying to sell you supplements will claim figures that are completely out with what the CDC, the Center for Disease Control in America, or that would ever claim. So they pick the higher range. So they say 50% of people are magnesium deficient, which is a nonsense. It's perhaps 20% at worst. If you're deficient of something, of course, that, I remember I mentioned homeostasis, balance. Deficiency is obviously not balance. But if you're eating a healthy diet, then you're going to be getting everything you need.
Yeah. And Ali, does this sort of relate as well to the microbiome? Is there a connection between good sleep and a healthy microbiome, or is that pretty much just basic stuff?
I mean, I think all of that's really in its infancy. I mean, obviously, we understand increasingly the link between the gut and the brain, and we understand increasingly that what goes on in the gut is really important in terms of our brain function and our overall health. So, intuitively, one would imagine that a healthy microbiome would translate in some way towards healthy sleep. But I think, I completely agree with Neil. I think, there's a real I think in some areas on, supplements for sleep or, particular foods that you should eat in order to induce good sleep. Really, what we're saying as sleep specialists is, have a healthy diet for all the benefits that a healthy diet brings you in terms of your overall health and well-being. But don't expect that, taking a magnesium supplement or having 7 bananas before bed is going to mean that you have a good night's sleep. So you absolutely you know, a healthy diet is part of what Neil and I are, you know, are advocating here, which is a healthy approach to your life generally, of which sleep and diet are an important part.
Okay. Now, a question for both of you. I'd just like to add this question because I know you've both been asked this a million times before each. What's the connection between cheese and dreams?
Well, I'll take that first because if you go onto the internet and you type cheese and dreams, my name comes up. because what happened, the British Cheese Council asked me as a sleep expert to comment on a press release that they were putting out. Now, I had nothing to do with the study, for to use a word, but there's a comment against it, and basically it said that if you eat cheddar or any English cheese, that you'll have nice dreams, and if you eat that nasty French stuff, it will give you nightmares. So as I say, there was never a study; it was just a press release. But somehow, I am now Mr. Cheese and Dreams. There is no connection. There is nothing in cheese that isn't in other foods which aren't related to poor sleep. Now, the thing is, my hypothesis is because cheese is very, very fatty, high calories, go back to about the body temperature, you're not going to sleep as well. You can only remember a dream if you wake up during it. If you have worse sleep, you'll remember more dreams. Therefore, cheese causes poor dreams. That's my scientific theory, but there is no connection at all between cheese and dreams, and certainly no connection between nasty French cheese giving you nightmares, which I thought was brilliant from the British Cheese Council.
Beautiful. I love it. So then, okay, let's get a little bit more serious now. So, Ali, why is our sleep affected when we're anxious? I mean, you know, on the surface, it makes sense. You know, you're anxious, therefore you're going to sleep bad. But why? I mean, what is the connection there?
Yeah, I mean, I see this a lot, and I was going to mention earlier, but I think sort of on the one hand, we've got a population that, you know, that we're trying to reach here who don't focus sufficiently on their sleep and kind of squeeze their sleep and don't have enough sleep. But I'm increasingly seeing another population in my sleep clinic, which is those who are really focused on having lots of sleep and plenty of sleep and optimizing their sleep. And you know, as Neil's mentioned, you know, are kind of a bit of a slave to these things that you read about on Google that are supposed to improve your sleep, and are becoming increasingly anxious about their sleep, and then are creating a sleep problem for themselves where that didn't exist before. Yeah. So I think we know that anxiety is frequently connected to sleep problems. And one of the problems is that if you're worried, or if there's stuff going on, you often ruminate about that when you're in bed, because there's, you know, all the other things that you're able to distract yourself with in the daytime just aren't there. And that excess worry and that rumination sort of activates you both physically and mentally, and it can be harder to fall asleep. Or even if you do fall asleep, you then wake up feeling anxious in the night, and then you can't get back to sleep because your mind is racing. So then you don't sleep enough, your sleep quality is not as good. And then the problem with that, of course, then is it becomes a vicious cycle, because we know that the relationship between sleep and anxiety is bidirectional. So sleep deprivation worsens your anxiety, and then you get this negative cycle of poor sleep or even insomnia and anxiety. So when you're not sleeping well, that certainly affects your mood and can exacerbate your anxiety. And then, as I say, the problem then comes is people are sort of worried that now I'm not sleeping. So, and I know that's bad for me, because Dr. Stanley told me it was bad for me. So, I think unfortunately the two things are really inexorably linked, and it's important to kind of really address both of them when one's treating somebody with a sleep and anxiety problem.
Yeah. So, Neil, it's been a difficult year, and anxiety has been a big feature in a lot of people's lives. Are there any demographic differences between groups who have been particularly affected by insomnia over the past year?
Well, of course, the data is still coming out, because, you know, we're doing it on the fly as it's happening. It would appear that, there's been two specific responses to COVID in sleep. One is that some people, a good proportion, maybe 20 to 30% of people, are actually sleeping better because they don't have to get up at the crack of dawn to get the commuter train into London.
It's those lucky buggers that got furlough pay, isn't it? Yeah, I'm very jealous
of. So all of these people, you know, this has been an ideal time. You can go to bed when you want because you can't go out. You can get up when you need because you don't have to get up to catch the train. And so for some people, this has been a boon. Whereas for others, that loss of routine has been hugely problematical because they haven't induced a new routine. So it's like, it doesn't matter what time I get up, so I can watch another episode of whatever on the streaming service. So so about 35 to 40% of people are having significantly worse sleep than they did in the past. It seems to have impacted the younger generation a lot more. This may be because they haven't learned, you know, the life skills, the resilience skills that somebody of my age perhaps has on board. And maybe the effect has been greater on them because, you know, once you get a mortgage, you can't go out anyway. Sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? You
need life's over.
Down into life. And for them, life is much more a 24/7 thing. And I think that's been the change, is that there's been a new discipline on their life, which they have no agency over. And I don't think they have that ability to adapt, perhaps, as much as others. So I say some people have just seen this as a really good opportunity of developing a good sleep behavior. So personally, I now can go to bed whenever I feel sleepy, and I've not set an alarm clock in the last year because I don't have to get up to travel halfway across the country to do a lecture. So for me, I'm sleeping better now than I've done in the previous 45 years as an adult. It's been great for me. But as I say, that's because my job allows it. But for others, I know it's been a real problem.
Yeah. Ali, how can we go about improving our sleep patterns, do you think?
I mean, I guess this follows on from what Neil's just alluded to there. I think routine is really, really important. Neil's already mentioned homeostasis, so that kind of need to find balance, and our bodies work in, you know, many of our bodily systems work on this basis. And we also have obviously our circadian rhythm that works essentially on the light and dark cycle. It tells us we should be asleep when it's dark and awake when it's light. And when we sort of work with that rhythm effectively, when we act to entrain that rhythm effectively, then we will tend to fall asleep more reliably when we want to and wake up more reliably when we need to. So I always tell people, you know, have a regular, primarily your getting up time, because most of us have to get up for something, even if we don't have to get on the commuter train anymore, you know, and fix that time and really try and stick to that at a minimum 4 to 5 days per week, and avoid having more than 2 consecutive days where you don't stick to that. So weekends are often quite tricky. And one of the reasons people struggle on a Monday morning is they've essentially got some social jet lag from their routines being completely out over the weekend. And then make sure you go to bed again at the same sort of time every night. And you'll find that you sleep much more reliably when you do that than when you know, I've lost count of the number of people that will come and see me in a sleep clinic. And when my first question is, what sort of time do you go to bed? They can't give me an answer because they just don't have a fixed bedtime. So I think routine's really important. And then, you know, thinking about what we were talking about in terms of anxiety, relaxation and kind of having some winding down time before bed's really important. So many people know about the problem with blue screens and melatonin, but actually, you know, a lot of the problem is what you're consuming on that screen immediately before you fall asleep. So, you know, horrible news about pandemics, you know, or just kind of the stimulation of social media, or as Neil says, you know, watching yet another box set on Netflix. You know, turn it off, wind down, let your body and brain know it's time for sleep, and stick with a routine.
It's easy to say that, but you know, I've been watching The Bridge. You know, life, like, you can't manipulate your life that easily. You're in their control, for crying out loud.
this is actually true. You know, the CEO of Netflix a couple of years ago said his biggest competitor is sleep. Not Amazon, not Hulu, but sleep. And this is why the time between episodes on Netflix is so short. Yeah. Because it doesn't give you time to go, it's 11 o'clock, maybe I should go to bed. So you are deliberately suckered into this, and that's the problem. And now we're talking about people you know, making alarms to tell you to go to bed, treating you like a child. If you're over the age of six, you know you should go to bed. You don't need YouTube or Amazon to tell you to go to bed. You're an adult. You know you should go to bed. And that's the problem. What I said earlier, we're suckered into consuming media because they need the advertising. That's it. They don't want you to switch off the telly. And this is why Ali mentioned the blue light blocking. You know, you strip that out on your phone. Well, actually, it makes no difference. It's light, not blue light. And two, why don't you just turn the blooming thing off? Therefore, you don't get any interruptions at all. And this is what we're like kiddies with a new toy. We haven't realized that we should actually put it down. You know, when I was growing up, I'm 55, but when I was growing up, nobody rang your house after 9 o'clock at night. You know, if they did, that meant granny was dead. That was the only reason anybody would ring you after 9 o'clock at night. Now, 26% of teenagers are woken up after they've gone to sleep by rings and dings and pings.
Well, and teenagers are a really, really interesting subject. I mean, they are the next generation to come through to be doing what we're doing now. But it feels as though their lives, you know, our control of social media is really, frankly, still in its infancy. You know, I've got two teenage girls. Their sleep patterns are all over the place. They sleep a lot, but at very strange times. Now, I suspect that that's a function of social media. You know, both they and myself and my wife are not that good at controlling it for them or helping them to control it. And so they are all over the place. My 16-year-old goes to bed the moment she gets home from school, and especially when she's been doing online schooling, absolutely exhausted. And she's asleep at 4:35 when she's going from school. And I think that there's, do you feel that there's going to be a big impact on this for the rest of their lives?
I think we have to be careful with teens because, you know, the problem with teen sleep is that teenagers are designed, they have a circadian shift, and they are designed to fall asleep a lot later than we as adults expect them to, and therefore wake up later than we as adults want them to, so that they can get themselves organized and get to school. And so, as Neil mentioned earlier on, in some ways, the pandemic, when schools were shut, worked really well for some teens. And you know, Neil mentioned that there's a proportion of individuals who, you know, found the pandemic, certainly lockdown at least, had a positive impact on their sleep. And there's some evidence that teens really found that because they were able to work more naturally with their circadian tendencies. So I think what we find is that a lot of teens are actually quite sleep deprived because they can't fall asleep much before midnight because they're just not designed that way. But they're having to get up at 6-7 o'clock in the morning to get themselves up and ready for school. And then they're having to start performing at school at a time when they're really not at their best. So I think you're right, you know, certainly social media and certainly the intrusion of devices is associated with sleep disruption in that group. But I think we do have to be a bit careful about blaming teens for being that tired when you know, their day just is not designed to work optimally with their intrinsic rhythm.
Well, I don't understand where's the fun in not blaming your children. It's much, much easier to live that way. Okay, now we could chat about this for hours and hours, but we ought to bring it to a close. Now, I know you've both touched on basic ideas about how to improve your sleep, but if you give us some of your key tips, maybe two or three of the key things that you think will help to improve our sleep, what would they be? Neil, if you can tell us first.
Well, I think the first one, I mean, you know, people have always asked, you know, always asked for the top 10 tips. But to me, there's really only one serious tip, which is take sleep seriously. Because if you take sleep seriously, then you will do the behaviors that will engender sleep. But if you don't ever see sleep as serious, then it's a non-starter. And this is, you know, again, what we were talking about, you know, eating a banana before bed. Yes, you could do that, but if you've got an uncomfortable mattress, an uncomfortable pillow, a small bed where your bed partner disturbs you, sleeping on a bright street with the window open with traffic noise, eating a banana is going to make no difference at all. So this is it. You've got to look, and I'm not blaming people for their sleep problems, but there's an awful lot of things that we could fix in our lives before we ever need to go and bother people like Ali. Because, you know, so as I say, we've mentioned the wind down routine. You can only sleep if you've got a quiet mind. If you're ruminating, worried about something, you won't ever get sleep. So a wind down routine, does it matter what you do? No, as long as you find it comfortable. The, you know, so it's this sort of things. We all know how to get a good night's sleep. And the one thing I, every time I lecture in person with real human beings, is they come up to me and they'll start saying, oh, should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do the other? And I just say yes. And they go, oh, thanks for your advice. And I'm thinking, I've not said anything. You know, when you go on holiday, you sleep well. Why? Lack of stress, relaxed, chilled out. This is what you need. It's no more complicated than that. We've made it complicated. We've made it scary. As Ali said, you know, people are lying in bed worrying, oh, if I don't get sleep in the next 10 minutes, I'm going to die or go mad or whatever. Mm. Oh, my God, I've still not fallen asleep. That's the problem. Sleep should be a great pleasure. We should quiet mind, relaxed body, bedroom conducive to sleep. That's it. Simple as that.
And as you say, sometimes it's just the approval. It's just the sense that somebody has said, yes, sleep is good. It's important. And, yeah. And people can and go, oh, okay, thank God for that. Just one extra question for you, though, Neil. Obviously, you do lots of lectures. What do you do when people fall asleep in your lectures? What do you say?
I am perfectly happy. I am absolutely... I think I've worked magic, and I'm actually good at my job. We talked about earlier about napping. The Japanese have this concept called inamuri, asleep but present. And so that means you can, even in a business meeting, be asleep, as long as you don't look like you're asleep, i.e. you don't dribble down your shoulder or snore. But you then, the minute you're needed in the room, you're in the room. So I just think that people who sleep in my lectures are just practicing in a Murray, and I think they're obviously clever people.
I love it. Okay, Ali, I know that it's a simplistic question, but your tips to help improve sleep, and even if that's more of a sort of systemic idea.
This group of people who I see increasingly who already do all this stuff, right, but can't sleep because they're so worried about all the things we've talked about in terms of perhaps when you don't sleep. I would say that, you know, the other secret to good sleep is really just to not give it too much attention. So beyond the routine, beyond the making sure your room isn't hellishly hot, really loud and bright, you know, actually sleep is a natural bodily process. You know, as we've already discussed and explained that, you know, every animal species has some form of sleep. It doesn't require a huge amount of attention. It certainly doesn't require a lot of money, you know, just let it come. Don't lie there worrying about the fact that you might, you know, develop some sort of horrible disease if you're not asleep right at this very moment. You haven't got exactly 8 hours every single night. You know, it will come when you let it be. So I think beyond the very simple and not at all exciting things that Neil and I have said, it's really also about just letting it be.
That's almost a little bit of mindfulness, but that's a whole other issue. Okay, well, Dr. Neil Stanley and Dr. Ali Hare, thank you so much for talking to me. I'm ready for a nap now, so I better go. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from food standards to lab-grown meat. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thanks so much for listening.